Hello mga ka-PI! Before your regular podcast, here is a message from our media partner. So, Sining Labinsyam or C-Lab, a group of Benilde students, would like to invite you to watch a play called Pamilya, which is about a story about a family that slowly gets entangled with the system of trolling and disinformation in Philippine politics. Now, of course, I've seen it myself. It is powerfully performed with a thought-provoking ending that I did not expect and is rich with discussion. So we'd like to invite you as well to watch. They have added a new show on November 22. You may watch it on Benilde, but also go through the streaming services. Get your tickets in the link from November 23rd to the 30th. So please watch and learn. You'll learn a lot from this play. And now back to our regularly scheduled podcast. Welcome to the PI Podcast, political insights for the palaging inis. I'm your host, Matt, and with me is my co-host, political scientist, meme lord, and chaser free people, Borge, away from his lawn.
Chasing free people away from my lawn. Okay, that was a little bit way off field. But hey, PI nyo, pay nating lahat, Borge at your service.
Yes, and today we have a very special edition of the PI Podcast because we are focusing on a new publication with a very important insights and message for Philippine democracy, and that we're here with the author of Chasing Freedom, the Philippines' Long Journey into Democratic Ambivalence. Now, before we let the author in to discuss the work, Borge, any initial impressions of the book, since we both took time to read this from, of course, our partners at Ateneo Press, so you can all get your copies of this wonderful book at Ateneo Press. But Borge, what do you think about this book?
Really good book, really great one. Mm. It's a nice addendum to, you know, Walter Posaka's other work on moral politics.
Yes.
Again, this amplifies the need to look at the psyche and subjectivity of citizens, which for the longest time have been relatively ignored by many scholars on Philippine politics, which is, again, a sad thing. So now it's high time to look at how Filipino citizens think in relation to public affairs. So, yeah, I would reserve more of my comments soon for our discussion. Mm-hmm. But yeah, as far as I'm concerned, this would be a nice part of the set of, you know, recent explorations on the Filipino psyche, Filipino political psyche.
And it's actually not just an academically enriching book, but, you know, as a Filipino reading this, I was actually a bit, you know, emotional about it. I can talk about that later, but like you said, both books, like Wataru's Moral Politics and Chasing Freedom, they can actually be considered like complementary works of each other, you know. Wataru talks about more of like the mass sphere, the lower income classes, the more common Filipino people. And while Adele Webb's book here, Chasing Freedom, is more on the middle class, you know, which again is a very interesting topic that, you know, we might want to elaborate on soon. So let us now introduce our guest. Now, she is currently a lecturer in policy and politics at the Queensland University of Technology at Brisbane, Australia. Please welcome Professor Adele Webb. So, hello, Adele.
Hello. Thanks for having me. And it's just Doctor. It's just Dr. Webb.
Oh, okay.
Adele, okay. Actually, is better. Adele.
Yeah, okay, Adele.
All right, Adele. So, first, let's start off with why did you decide to write this book on Philippine politics? You know, as people who study it as well, you know, it's quite exciting, but also can be a bit depressing. So why did you choose, of all democracies, you know, to study about this topic? Yeah.
Well, as a non-Filipino, you know, I can say, kind of objectively speaking, I guess, the Philippines is a fascinating country to study, especially if you're interested in international politics. I mean, it's a country that's been caught up in rival empires for almost five centuries, you know, subject, of course, to iterations of imperialism from the Spanish, the Americans, the Japanese, and today, of course, it's at the center of this kind of delicate dance between China and the US over the West Philippine Sea. So it's a fascinating place to study, sort of from the outside. in terms of democracy as well, it's also really interesting because, you know, it's often bantered around as Asia's oldest democracy, but it's also included in this kind of discussion on, you know, a new democracy or democracy in the third wave of democratization in the late 80s, early 90s. So these two kind of descriptors of democracy as both old and new, I found really fascinating, and I think kind of speak to some of the contradictions and ambiguity in the way Philippine democracy has been studied. But actually, I wasn't introduced to the Philippines through academic books or academic journal articles at all. I was my kind of introduction was a much more personal one. My first visit to the Philippines and to Manila was in 2010, when I volunteered with an organization called the Institute for Studies in Asian Church and Culture, ISAC, based in Manila. And I helped them produce some radio editorials on voting and good governance and democracy in the lead up to the May election. And during that time, I also managed to get myself accredited as an international election observer and went down to Negros in to Bacolod City. And I ended up on election day in this small community called Pulapandan, just outside of Bacolod City. And there's many things that I could say about what I saw and what I learned and what I puzzled over during that period, which is, it's sort of too much for today, but only to say that I became really intrigued, you know, not so much kind of intellectually, but also emotionally, because I had this personal connection with the Philippines that was growing and in intensity. And I became really intrigued about, I guess, the obstacles to a more transformative politics. You know, I wasn't really persuaded by explanations of weak institutions, and I certainly wasn't persuaded by explanations about naivety or somehow kind of, you know, unsophistication in understanding what democracy is, which I found a lot in the democratization literature. I also became interested in the role of the middle class, because after all, you know, my colleagues and my friends in Manila were middle class, and I was just, there were many things that I shared in common with them in terms of perspectives, but there were other things that I didn't quite understand, and that made me, you know, kind of curious as well. But at the same time, these were some of the most sophisticated thinkers that I'd met. I was involved in the global justice movement at that time, working with NGOs, and the Filipinos that I was working with were the leaders in that movement. So I was curious about how a place that was home to some of the most sophisticated civil society leaders in the world was also the home to this very stagnant politics. And so I there was just a deep curiosity that kind of emerged. I ended up leaving the NGO work in about 2012 and went to do my master's in London, where I thought a little bit about these questions, but then, you know, decided to kind of keep thinking about them and started my PhD in Sydney in 2013. And the book, to get back to your original question, the book is really largely a product of my dissertation that I did for the PhD. At least the research was done during that period. So, that's sort of the long story of how what inspired the book.
It was intrigued at first sight.
Speaking of that intriguement, you mentioned that you actually experienced the elections like on the field, and interestingly, like in Negros, in Bacolod. And I just want to ask, maybe what are some of these, you know, intriguing observations that you had? Because I myself have not been in elections outside of Metro Manila. You know, I don't know if Borge has, but it might be interesting to tell us. And maybe did any of these observations make it to your book, or maybe help inform you in your book? Yeah.
They definitely informed it. They didn't make it in because sort of I ended up kind of focusing on slightly different things. But it's interesting that you say that, because that was exactly my experience. I went back to Manila in 2010, back to my friends and my colleagues who were working on, you know, good governance and, you know, voting material and so on.
Yes.
And there was a real disjuncture between what I had just seen and experienced and the language that they were, the conversations that they were having.
Yes.
You know, that people, if they just you know, didn't sell their vote, then they could transform the country. But what I had seen was something completely different. I mean, it didn't matter if these people sold their vote and by the way, I didn't blame them at all, because what I saw in this particular small community was incredible. I mean, it was controlled by the family that owned the land, and the people were considered simply tenants on the land. And it was like you were stepping back into the 19th century. And the political family that owned the land and obviously then kind of held political office literally said to us, well, they live on our land, so why wouldn't they vote for us? And we spoke to people who had voted against the mayor in the last election and had been kind of basically driven out of the village and weren't welcome there. There were assassination attempts between the two rival candidates. We were kind of chased in our van by goons with guns. And this happened again when I went back in 2013, by the way, up to Tagagarao and around sort of very northern Luzon. And we also got kind of threatened, you know, you can go in there, but you won't come out sort of thing. So the extent to which kind of control of land influenced, you know, who people could vote for, and who would, what the outcome of elections, and also just the kind of the prevalence of private armies. And, you know, I mean, you read about this stuff a lot, but when you experience it, you know, you realize that those individual citizens up there, my Manila friends were talking to them saying, you know, vote wisely, you know, vote. And I just thought, it's actually, it's not about being wise. It's about this kind of 150-year-old structures of land ownership which prohibit these people from being able to kind of exercise their vote in a transformative way. So we literally went back to Manila and back to the sort of diplomatic community, and they said, was it a free and fair election? And I just thought, oh, how do you even answer that question? Because, you know, what we've seen is so much more complex than that question can address. So I guess thinking about it, as I say it, you know, that experience really prompted me to go deep into the history and to not be satisfied with sort of starting the story in the late 70s, which a lot of work on middle-class politics especially does in the Philippines, because it sort of assumes that really the interesting stuff only started in the late 70s leading up to people power. But I was much more interested in kind of digging deeper into the historical roots and especially the kind of colonial legacies. Yeah.
It's kind of like a powerful irony, like democracy is supposed to treat all citizens as equals, and yet you observe the vast inequality, not just in economic, but sheer like their identities, like they see each other, they see themselves as like beholden to these landlords. And yeah, it's, and speaking of like ironies and contradictions, one of the central concepts of your book is democratic ambivalence, you know. And so what is democratic ambivalence, and why do you think this is an important phenomenon?
It's sort of the central concept that I build in the book, using the case of the Philippines. And I should start by saying ambivalence is, I'm increasingly becoming aware, one of the most misused terms in the academic literature. It's often, you know, thrown around as a kind of a placeholder for something we don't understand or something that's uncertain, or if referring to citizens or voters, it's often that they are undecided or they're unsure about something, so they're ambivalent. But actually, you know, ambivalence is actually a much more complex and spirited idea than those treatments suggest. And my concept of democratic ambivalence, I define that as a synchronous and sustained holding of conflicting feelings about democracy. So it's a saying of yes and no to democracy at the same time. And it's not transient, it's not temporary, but it's rather stable and persistent. And interestingly, it's sort of a phenomenon or an empirical reality for which the kind of political science literature in particular has very little understanding of, and in fact very little tolerance for, because of course the ideal citizen in a democracy is one who is unconditionally, unequivocally committed to democracy, and ambivalence is not that. So yeah, that's kind of what it is. And in terms of kind of where I found it, I guess, in the research, well, I mean, I don't do survey research or statistical analysis primarily, but you can find it in the statistical kind of data. So if you just go to the World Value Survey, for example, to see public opinion data, you'll find that in the most recent wave in the Philippines, that was taken in 2019, 66%, so two-thirds of university-educated respondents expressed this simultaneous support for a democratic political system and support for a strong leader who doesn't have to bother with Congress and elections. So that's a kind of saying of yes to democracy and yes to autocracy at the same time, or yes to kind of autocratic leadership. And that kind of statistical finding you can is very stable. So since the beginning of the World Value Survey in the Philippines, over sort of 25 or so years, that has been stable. So it's not a new phenomenon. And it sort of cuts across social classes. But what I was really kind of, I guess, interested in illuminating more was the fact that this was very prevalent amongst and a kind of educated middle class cohort who we would expect from the democratization literature to be the ones to be least likely to be ambivalent, because they're meant to be the vanguard of democratic values. They're meant to be the ones that are most committed of all kind of citizens. So that was very interesting. But I also found it when I did sort of long narrative interviews with my middle class respondents, and when I analyzed the narratives that they were telling me about what democracy means to them and how they experience it and so on, which were sort of 1 or 2 hour conversations, what came out of that was this kind of very contradictory adage, which really centers on this idea of freedom. So they kept saying to me that democracy is freedom. So the idea of freedom most accurately encapsulates their idea of democracy. At the same time, freedom is kind of a dangerous thing in the Philippines. So, you know, this idea that the Philippines is a freedom-loving country, but in the Philippines, freedom needs restraint. So, you know, democracy is good because it gives us freedom, but too much democracy in the Philippines is dangerous. So that's how I saw the ambivalence kind of emerging in the narratives of my respondents. And I think that's really important because, you know, even those people who are very committed to statistical analysis for research of kind of political attitudes would concede that we need more qualitative work to understand and really unpack some of these survey results. So, for example, you know, what do you do with survey data that says 66% of people have contradictory views? What do you do with that? How do you understand that unless you really delve into it qualitatively? So I kind of did that through the interviews, and then of course I did that through the kind of genealogy of ambivalence, looking at the historical story and where it came from and what its content was, what produced it, and what it might be responsible for producing as well.
I would like to ask, as I was reading your book regarding the understanding of freedom, did your respondents make a distinction between their individual freedom and the freedom of others?
Both of them were included in. That's a really interesting question, and people have written tens of thousands of books on freedom. It's such an interesting concept and different understandings of freedom. Both came up in the narrative. So there was an idea of kind of like being free, citizens being free to do whatever they wanted to do. At the same time, there was this idea of collective freedom, and that was most kind of, I guess, emblematic in, or most kind of signified in, the people power story. So those respondents who weren't super young, who had that in their historical memory, sort of took that moment as the moment that most symbolized the country's love of freedom, because collectively people were demanding freedom. So it was both sort of a sense of, you know, individual freedom. I can say what I want, I can do what I want, at the same time as this collective freedom, which I'm sure we'll get to, but it's very interesting because actually those same people then explained to me that they were they were prepared to tolerate the curbing of that individual and collective freedom for the sake of transformation. So yeah, hence the kind of paradox or the irony in there.
Yeah. But maybe both of you can answer this, because now that I'm thinking about it, I don't think if you can find anyone that is 100%, for example, for this freedom. In fact, people have different ideas of freedom. They have freedom in some areas, but maybe they don't believe in certain freedoms in others, you know, depending on like if they're conservative or progressive. So maybe I'm going to ask, though, how can you tell if someone is democratic ambivalent? Like, what's the most sure sign of democratic ambivalence as compared to maybe any other individual who, you know, has different like ideas of freedom? You know, I think, I don't know if that makes sense.
I mean, it does. And I think, I don't think, you know, democracy doesn't equal total freedom. That's a yeah. misunderstanding of democracy, isn't
okay.
it? Because in a democracy, you know, we actually agree that some things are not tolerated, and that, you know, individual kind of freedom is not prioritized. Otherwise, we'd be living in a chaotic, dangerous, disorderly society. So I guess that kind of negotiation of freedom is something that democracy is familiar with and accommodates. And so you can support democracy without kind of believing that you should be free to do whatever, you know, it is that you want to do. At the same, the other end of the spectrum, you know, saying that you that it is preferable, which is what the survey data kind of draws out, preferable to have a strong leader who doesn't have to bother with Congress and elections, is kind of effectively saying, you know, that it's better to give up the rights that democracy does kind of enshrine, and give that power over to one individual. So that, I think that's where the real kind of distinction is.
Yeah.
I don't know if you have any thoughts.
I think I do agree with Adele's conclusion here, especially from the quantitative perspective. But I think building on your work and building on your comments on that contradiction, I think a democratically ambivalent person is, well, again, democracy is about negotiating the borders of freedom. But I think he or she becomes more ambivalent when he or she is willing to short circuit the process of negotiation and just, you know, just ask for a disciplinarian to draw the lines. So a democracy would include everyone in this negotiation, a constant struggle to draw the borders of freedom. But when you start asking someone else, you know, a dictator to, you know, just do it, I think that is where, you know, that's where it becomes more problematic. And in the Philippines, we have very deep connections with leaders. So there is that lingering tendency to simply just rely on a leader to just, you know, we could not regulate it on our own. We don't have enough time or resources or brain cells to negotiate with other Filipinos. It just deal with it. So I think that's a problem. It makes it a
movement. I think you're right, and that gets mentioned often. I guess what I wanted to elucidate in the book was that I see that as more complex than simply kind of part of Filipino culture or what we might say is kind of like traditional, I don't know, values, or that it's like it predates sort of imperial interventions in the country. And what I tried to really emphasize is that phenomenon that you're talking about, that kind of deferring to a leader or deferring to kind of this more sovereign, or, you know, to be subject to someone else and to give your rights over to that person, give authority to that person because you sort of fall in line and you don't feel, you know, worthy to kind of hold authority that actually democracy gives to citizens. That, I think, is in large part, well, if it was there already in some measure, it was exacerbated to a great extent under the Americans. because that is exactly the way they legitimated their colonial democracy in the Philippines. It was to play on that, to really exacerbate it, and to put it in, you know, very frank terms, to gaslight Filipinos into thinking that, you know, that's actually true, when it's not true. It wasn't true at all, because the Philippines had already a constitution, a Congress. It had, you know, it's just that the Americans couldn't conceive of an Asian nation being an independent, you know, country with a parliament that actually is experimenting with democracy. That's for white European countries to do, not for not for Asian countries to do. But in fact, that's what was happening in the Philippines. It was this kind of civic uprising and civic kind of moment of flourishing. But yeah, that was really constrained by the entry of the Americans.
I mean, that leads to the next question, which is like, where does this ambivalence come from? And your book focuses a lot on tracing it from, as what you said right now, the colonial impacts from the American occupation. So I'm curious as to maybe why you think these imperial colonial legacies are still persist to today, and maybe even Borge can maybe comment on that as well. But yeah, but how much of it is still the American legacy, and maybe are there other things that allow this democratic ambivalence to persist? So where else does this come from?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I think, you know, we of course, it's not a simple kind of story of, you know, American colonialism equals contemporary democratic ambivalence. But I think, you know, I sort of catalog in the book the way that I think this dual kind of understanding or dual approach to democracy that on the one hand says, you know, we love democracy because it's about being free, and we are, you know, we're a country who aspires to be democratic. And on the other hand, this kind of anxiety about the capacity to be free and the capacity of Filipinos to live within the bounds of freedom that democracy provides. I think it was kind of nurtured under the American, you know, colonial period, and then has been carried within a middle class kind of subjectivity or consciousness about, you know, democracy. And what I sort of try to document in the book is the way that, you know, you can first see it in middle class language by doing kind of newspaper interviews. You really see this taking on of the American narrative that, like, we love democracy, but, oh gosh, it's our fault because we're really bad at it. We're morally corrupt. You know, we need the Americans to come back in, you know, thank God for the Americans. And it's extraordinary to the extent to which that was reproduced. But then, of course, you know, it's not being reproduced exactly in the same form for another five decades, but you see it kind of manifest in other things. And what is particularly interesting is the way that the political elite became masters at kind of mobilizing this narrative. And I think that has been in large part kind of the thing that's produced the continuity is you get, you know, you got leaders sort of straight after the independence, the kind of independence moment. You have Marcos Sr., who was really, you know, probably the best that the country's seen at mobilizing ambivalence. He did it so well. He kind of tapped into both of these narratives. One, you know, we have dignity. We are Filipinos. We are, you know, how dare you suppress us and oppress us, and how dare you kind of colonize us and blah, blah, blah. And at the same time, basically saying, but I will, you know, but Filipinos need discipline and I'll be the one to discipline them. So he was a master at that. And then we, you know, history unfolded the way that it did because middle-class people really resonated with that narrative. And then obviously a lot of time passed, but, you know, Duterte was very similar in his dual narratives that he used to mobilize support, especially middle-class support. So he said, we need law and order. You know, I won't spare anybody. I'll throw the bodies into the ocean, whatever, you know, disgusting things that he said. at the same time, he was all about dignity of the Philippine nation. He was all about, you know, how dare you, how dare Obama question me about human rights, and how dare you, you know. So he was really playing on these lingering anxieties that actually are contradictory to each other, but that have persisted and still persist, arguably, today. So I think the reason why the ambivalence has been so persistent and durable is because these anxieties, they don't easily go away. And I don't think that's unique to the Philippines. I don't think the Philippines is exotic for having resonant nationalist narratives or anxieties. You know, just look at what's happening in the United States. That country has, you know, incredible ideas about itself that it tells itself over and over again that are just a product of history that are kind of quite crazy, really, to the rest of us. But they've been there for, you know, 150 years. So these things don't easily go away, I think.
Yeah, so the problems are internalized. The mentality of the need for a guiding hand internalized by Filipinos. The necessity of a guiding hand, which is, again, a primary colonial legacy. No, which reminds me, no, I think yesterday during one of my classes, I did an experiment on my students. Okay. Just to, because it's an introduction to political psychology. So I told my students that, again, the syllabus is a social contract. We agree on this during the first day. And there's no quiz. There are no exams on that on the syllabus. And then yesterday, I announced a surprise quiz for my students. I told them it's a long quiz, a post-midterm exam. None of them resisted. None of them resisted. And when I said that it's, okay, it's an experiment, and their explanation was, would vary from they were shocked. And someone actually said that, sir, because we trust you. Because my question was, why didn't you resist an arbitrary act of power? And another person said that because the educational institution had provided power to the professor, that the professor can do as much. And again, the Delasong University is an American legacy. I think another one actually said that I did another experiment. Someone was late. So I modified the experiment. I said that you're late. You're going to have an exam. You also did not resist. And his explanation was, because, sir, I feel ashamed that I was late and I think I deserved it.
Oh, wow.
And that, you know, it's just, I told my students, can we be democratic if you have undemocratic tendencies at the school? Wow. So that illustrates how deeply we have internalized not only the implications of the benevolent assimilation, the idea of benevolent assimilation, but also this need for a guiding hand and this tendency to simply trust, to trust the guiding hand or be afraid of it, really. And one of my students actually said that we're afraid of our grades.
It might just be like a you problem, because when I try to do it, they say, but sir, you can't give assignment. Yeah, I need 1 week in advance. So like, they push back against me all the time.
Or probably I'm just scared of you. I think they're just extra scared of you.
It depends on the leader, I guess. No?
You have great authority.
I suppose that's perhaps there. Well, and the politicians here, you know, there maybe some are better at wielding that authority than others, and they see that, I guess. Some people some people try to do the same thing. In some ways, Isko Moreno, like, who tried to run, tried to act like a strong leader, but he wasn't believed, and they prefer the unity, Marcos and Duterte. I don't know, maybe that's the case now. But speaking of which, like you mentioned already, as goes from the American imperial occupation up until the campaigns of Duterte, you know, the middle class was definitely, you know, active in both, you know, in this mobilization. My question is, now, of course, why focus on middle class? Like, a lot of the literature focuses on the middle class as that turning point of responsible for transitioning a lot of countries, you know, whether it be democratically or otherwise, you know. And the second is maybe, I have to ask this now just to make clear, like who are the middle class? Like, which middle class are you talking about here? Because clearly, there are many ways to identify the middle class. There are many segments of the middle class here. If we try to define a middle class, it might be different. You know, three of us here, mm-hmm. maybe we have three different answers of the middle class with maybe very little intersection. But which middle class are you talking about in your book? So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. They're really great questions. So why focus on the middle class? Yeah, as you said, like the democracy literature puts a great emphasis on the middle class. And I think, you know, for all the lip service paid to kind of complexity of democratic transitions and so on, the middle class is still presumed as a kind of, temperature gauge of democratic health. If you've got a large middle class who support democracy, then you're on your way. Good for you, sort of thing. And the foreign affairs analyst Joshua Kalancic, in his 2013 book on democratic backsliding in the developing world, he actually says that there's few middle classes that have failed to emulate the predictions of modernization theory as dramatically as in the Philippines. So he's really singling the Philippines out as kind of like a real, you know, you've failed to do what this theory said that you were meant to do. But I guess the question becomes, like, should the emphasis here be on the failure of the Philippine middle class to act in the way that it should have or should do? Or does it speak more to a kind of a failure on our part as scholars to really understand the complexity of middle-class political positions and attitudes? And, you know, as I mentioned earlier, like in sort of the contemporary literature, the middle class have gone from being the kind of heroes of this modernization paradigm to being at the center globally of debates about democratic decline and democracy in crisis. So you have, you know, from Trump, I mean, the middle class supported Trump in alarming numbers. You've got to Orban, to Bolsonaro, which of course is history because he's gone now. And of course, in the Philippines, you have these kind of authoritarian populist figures that really capture the allegiance of significant segments of the middle class, despite or perhaps because they're actually, you know, they pose a threat to democratic institutions and processes of government. But I think there's been somewhat of an acceptance that empirical reality is differing from what modernization theory predicted. So we can sort of put that aside and say, okay, you know, that's very problematic now. But what I think is the sticking point really in what I try to address in the book is not sort of the acknowledgement that the middle classes aren't doing what we expect them to do, but like, how do we make sense of their political behavior? So if they're not doing what we expected them to do, what are they doing and why are they doing it and how do we understand it? So how do we understand middle class consciousness? And I think this is where I like to think that the methodological contribution of my book comes in, because what I try to undertake is something very kind of little undertaken, which is a kind of a historical analysis of middle class understandings of democracy. So we often kind of look at a point in time, whether it be a point around a particular election of somebody or a survey point, data point or whatever, and we say, you know, the middle class thinks this, but we don't really put that into relief over a historical kind of perspective. And I think that's important to do, because I think middle class consciousness is a much more complex and protracted, the development of that consciousness is a much more complex and protracted process. It's not linked to some universal law of, middle class identity. It's rather linked a lot to the context of the transition, the kind of the power dynamics within a particular nation and so on. But I think that kind of gets back to the second question about which middle class I'm talking about and who are the middle class. And here I will, kind of concede that I decided kind of quite early on in the research not to fixate on exactly who was in and who was out of my definition of middle class. That's because rather than kind of focusing on a group of people, because I couldn't do that. You can't do historical analysis with that sort of demographic kind of identification. I focus more on middle class ideas, middle class discourses, and middle class narratives. And there, the way I defined that was not by kind of how much money people had or what jobs they did, but rather about how they kind of a relational definition of middle class. So the middle class discourses that I found, for example, in the Philippine Free Press in the late 1940s were really evident, because these voices are clearly identifying the people above them and the people below them. So by that, as middle class. Then kind of come to the contemporary period, and when I did my interviews, obviously there I had to decide, you know, which were my respondents. And there it was really, you know, I mean, to be very kind of, what do you call it? Like, you know, it's in the, social weather station, the kind of categorization. So it's C-class that I interviewed, but, you know, a range of people that were, you know, not only people that kind of maybe had a particular income, but people that were involved in different sectors, who were different levels of political kind of activity, different political orientations, and so on. So I didn't, I just sort of decided not to fixate too much on kind of exactly which people were middle class and who weren't. I think it didn't, that didn't kind of fit with the nature of the research. So I'm not sure if that answers your question or not.
I think that is, I do appreciate your approach regarding class analysis, because again, class analysis is a very tricky business to be a part of. It's very tricky. And your focus on subjectivity actually exposes the complexities of the middle class. But I would like to ask one question. From this perspective, from the perspective of subjectivity, from the perspective of political psychology and sociology, given that the middle class identifies itself in relation to the upper class and the lower classes, in relation to the nation, and of course they're more exposed to the world outside, is the middle class in general, in a very abstract terms, is it destined to have split personalities? To be, to an extent, schizophrenic?
Well, I should be asking you that question. You're the expert on political psychology. Well, I think, you know, why shouldn't we expect people to have very complex sort of opinions or attitudes? And so I sort of, I kind of think, I mean, I don't know whether I'd call it schizophrenic, but I do think that the literature on kind of political attitudes and democratic attitudes in particular needs to become much more comfortable with complexity and with contradictions within people's opinions and attitudes and values. And I think we need to learn from the political psychology literature, which says this is not surprising at all. This is actually just how people are. You know, we all hold contradictory ideas about things. None of us walk around with kind of, you know, very, very definite, you know, ideas about everything that never contradict. That's just not realistic. But the political science literature in particular became, and still is largely, quite obsessed with this binary when it comes to democratic attitudes between, you know, a yes or a no. And what, you know, it's partly because it's much easier to measure and work with the data if you if you make it that simple. And that's where I think we really need to challenge our methods. And, you know, just become more comfortable with saying this is complex. So I think the middle class in particular has suffered from a lack of analysis, partly because it's been presumed that we already know how middle class people think, so we don't need to study them. Or I think on the other extreme, people, as scholars, think it's too heterogeneous, like it's too it's too complex, there's too many different varieties, I can't understand that, so I won't. Whereas if you want to talk about the elite, well, we can do that quite confidently. If you want to talk about the kind of lower socioeconomic groups, we can do that more confidently. But the middle class is kind of really, for one reason or another, escaped or eluded, especially historical analysis. And I think we need to address that. And I don't think it's easy. I think and it does kind of complicate our thinking about democratization quite a lot, but we need to do it. So that's just it.
Yeah. Well, I think one thing that I want to highlight here, and you're right in saying that the middle class is a very unstable thing, is it's not a lot of the middle class, especially today, especially with the growth that the Philippines has, used to be far lower, like on the lower class, and they just moved up. Their income, which is the usual basis of class, has gone up. So the assumption is, you know, the middle class at least has a house, has at least a stable residency. Well, now in some of the metrics of the middle class, there are quite a number of them that live in slums. You know, they do have a big income, but they don't spend it on getting proper residence. So perhaps their sense of security and the sense of a good leader is somewhat affected by that kind of, insecurity. You know, like it's not enough, income is no longer enough, you know, unless that's the middle class now. The middle class in the Philippines is quite insecure, especially with the pandemic, you know. It shrank, or like the nature of the middle class, like despite earning a certain amount, being able to afford a lot of things, you know, but they're still in slums. So that's, I wouldn't say it's schizophrenic, but their contradictory existence or their conditions kind of affected and created the contradictory psychology, don't you think? Yeah, I don't know. I mean, because that's, I suppose that's where we can trace it, you know, their basic existence, you know. Any thoughts on that?
Maybe you've just yourself answered the question about, you know, whether it's useful to look at income as a identifier of middle class, because, you know, maybe we need to be much more pluralistic about our indicators, if we want to use indicators, but also even look at kind of, you know, habitus kind of ideas about culture and language and kind of normative kind of ideas, things that aren't, you know, this is not unique. I know what you mean exactly, but it's not unique to the Philippines. So, you know, in Australia, there's been this kind of, we call it, it's a terrible term, but there's a term called cashed up bogan. And a bogan in Australia is someone who's considered like, you know, a bit crass and a bit like just not having the culture of a middle class person, unsophisticated, right?
Yeah.
Unsophisticated. And so if you're a cashed up bogan, you're someone who has, you know, is maybe a plumber, and plumbers have a very lucrative business here in Australia. Mm. They earn a lot of money. So you're still a plumber in your culture, in your, like, what you like to do on the weekend and how much education you had, et cetera, et cetera. But you've got a lot of money in your bank account, and you've probably, you know, got one or two mortgages for homes. So it's complex, you know. What is, do you define that person as the middle class? Well, you can, but then you're going to come into all sorts of problems, like you've just mentioned, when you try to understand their political, their kind of opinions and beliefs. So, I mean, I'm not, you know, I'm not an expert on kind of developing a identifying middle classes in terms of kind of operationalizing it, but I think we should agree that kind of income alone is should be thrown out the window, basically.
Yeah. So, just to flesh this methodological issue out. So, do you think it's better to, you know, just simply ask people if they identify as the middle class, meaning that they're conscious that they're trapped between different worlds, different extremes, that they're scared of the poor, that they're scared of the rich, they're trapped in a nation while wanting to go out. So is it better to do that, to try to operationalize the middle class? You know, just ask them if they have that.
I think it's really I think it's really important to do that. And I think like a lot of studies do that now. Mm. I mean, obviously it's more difficult because you can't simply use kind of a readily available data to identify a cohort as middle class and then study their values and so on. But I think self-identification is really important, because it is, you know, if we're really kind of drilling down on what class consciousness is, it's a sense of being and a sense of who you are. And that is so much more than like an indicator of income or your industry. It has to be about, you know, also about how you see yourself in relation to others. So I don't think it's the only way to study it, but I do think it's a really important way to do it.
I suppose it can be discussed for hours and months, you know, but this is something important to at least consider. But I suppose the next thing we can consider is perhaps I want to ask, like, how your findings in a way, how they stand with regards to the current, well, the results of the recent elections, of the latest expression of these political attitudes, especially with the return of the Marcoses into power. Especially when, and people, I think, presume that a lot of the Marcos voter base was, again, the disinformed and the uneducated, but there are actually quite a huge chunk that were part of the middle class, especially the middle class, quote unquote, that can be traced back to also Duterte. You know, people were surprised that a lot of the middle class supported Duterte. So I don't know, what can you say about, again, the democratic ambivalence with I think the past two elections in particular, which actually is an expression of, in a way, anti-democratic leaders through a democratic process.
It's complicated, isn't it? And that's a really interesting question. And I mean, my thoughts on this are still very embryonic. So you know, because it's very recent, and I haven't published kind of on this yet, but I have been thinking about it, you know, as many others have been. And I think in terms of kind of my contribution and what that might say about the most recent kind of election, I mean, my book really hopefully demonstrates the resonance of historical narratives in Philippine politics. So how political actors can kind of mobilize political support and electoral support using, you know, tapping into these kind of resonant narratives. And so, as I mentioned before, for Duterte, it was really this clear kind of dual narratives. This one, on the one hand, this law and order, you know, hard on, tough on crime stance, narrative, discipline the people. We need, you know, they need to be disciplined, like in Davao, blah, blah, blah. And I don't say blah, blah, blah to diminish it, but just, you know what I mean. And this kind of idea of national dignity, this idea of, like, you know, he literally said, you know, if I represent the Filipino people, you know, I'm not a puppet for anyone else. I'm really standing up for you. So I'm the champ. I'm going to be a champion of the Filipino people because they deserve dignity. And as I said, this was very much like Marcos Sr., because he played into these two lingering kind of anxieties very effectively. And I think that has cleared the way for the Marcos result. So, I mean, there is many factors involved in the election of Marcos Jr. I don't want to kind of downplay other things which are really important, but which I don't concentrate on in the book, like, you know, information ecosystems, disinformation, social media, the kind of the role of local politics and so on. All of that stuff needs to be considered. But the Marcos Jr. campaign ran on this promise of unity, didn't it? You know, this very simple promise of unity. And I think the historical picture that I create in the book explains why that would be so resonant, that idea of unity. And I think that it sort of, what it did was kind of put an umbrella over Duterte's two narratives. So unity can kind of accommodate or can represent both the strong arm of discipline and the dignity of the nation, because, you know, we need to be unified. You know, we all need to kind of fall into line. So we all should, you know, we should stop. I mean, he mentioned this often, or his team mentioned this often, because he didn't mention anything very often in the campaign, let's be honest. But, you know, that you know, we should stop asking questions about the past. We should stop fighting between ourselves. We just need to kind of all fall in line behind him. And on the other hand, you know, this idea of kind of that somehow is a dignifying picture of what the Philippines is. And I, as I said, I haven't published on this yet. It's very kind of embryonic, but I do see a resonance, and this is perhaps surprising, between this narrative of unity and the kind of propositions and the narratives around people power, the people power trope, because I think the people power trope was about everyone coming together, everyone standing as one, and in doing that, overcoming something that's kind of bigger than you that you need to overcome. So I actually, whereas some people would see this as, you know, and the end of the people power era. So the election of, if Duterte was kind of the signal that it was on its last legs, the Marcos Jr. result is like, okay, well, the people power era is gone, it's over. We need to draw a line under that. Whereas I actually would draw a line of continuity between the kind of the trope of people power and the narratives that especially the middle class perpetuate around it, and the kind of narrative of unity that Marcos used. And in the book I talk about how I think that the people power moment, rather than doing what the world thought that it was doing, which was basically signaling that the Philippines was now unconditionally committed to democracy, like we're over autocracy, we've done with dictatorship, we're like, but I actually think that the people power moment accommodated ambivalence very well. It didn't actually require people to sort of renounce their ambivalence. It played to it, and it actually accommodated it. And you had, you know, conversations immediately after people power in 1986 where, you know, there were conversations about how the moral character of Filipinos had led to Marcos being in power and doing what he did. So again, it's like done something wrong. Yeah, you're morally shaming people as individuals because they're sort of somehow inherently corrupt and they caused Marcos to be in power. And you're thinking, what? What's that? You know, like, how does that come into it? But that was what, you know, academics and politicians were talking about immediately after people power, alongside this kind of idea of, like, you know, that the Philippines had finally kind of proven itself worthy of democracy and worthy of dignity on the international stage and all this stuff. So the people power movement is much more complex, I think, than we've acknowledged. And I, you know, I really want to explore in my next, you know, piece of work, this kind of relationship between those two moments. I don't know if you think that that's preposterous and outrageous.
I really appreciate it, but I don't know if you would agree with this one. But as I have been reading your book, first thought that came into my head is this dialectics without mentioning Hegel?
No,
you know,
he's an Hegelian.
out of the people power promise. It's not about the destruction of the promise of people power per se, but some parts of it were sustained in bringing about this new, you know, leanings toward authoritarianism, and in possibility in the future, the people power, the legacies of people power, may be, you know, become a part of a larger and new, you know, integrative interpretation of how democracy should work. I know, but in people power, I think I do agree with your argument. It's continuity. In terms of the leader centrism that is in people power to an extent, was sustained and now is the one being used as a platform by Duterte and Marcos. So yeah. I don't know. Are you consciously applying a dialectical approach to?
No.
No, I don't, to be honest. Okay.
accidental, okay. Maybe.
Yeah, well, it's something to maybe think through a bit more constructively. So I will take it as a prompt to do it. No.
Something to consider. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, what I got, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it's kind of strange to think about, but the unity campaign captured the spirit of people power in all but name. In other words, the spirit of people power of unity is actually more represented by the unity team, the Duterte and Marcos. Do I have that right? Because that's a painful irony. it didn't require necessarily a villain. It's not a specific villain, but the villain is technically anyone who speaks against Marcos or who, how you say, is
divisive.
Anyone who is not with them is against them, but it's not specific. But yeah, did I understand that correctly?
Yeah, it's somewhat, I think. And I think, you know, I think the ultimate irony, of course, is that People Power, you know, sent Marcos and his family, including Marcos Jr., you know, is fleeing to Hawaii.
Yeah.
And here we have this connection between the two events. So I think, I mean, it's not a kind of absolute equivalence. So I think, you know, there are still things in People Power, and I don't want to diminish that moment. I mean, as a, you know, going back to the very beginning when we talked about my first experiences in the Philippines, you know, I was so captured and captivated by, you know, stories and recollections and narratives and inspiration that was drawn from that moment. And I do kind of get tingles thinking about people staring down tanks, you know, for the sake of freedom. And it's not to diminish that moment. Because I don't think it's, you know, the intentions of any of the actors who are present trying to defy Marcos and his brutality, who should be kind of held responsible. But under the surface, so maybe on the top layer, you know, it's a different thing. But under the surface, you know, we do need to interrogate the propositions of People Power. And they might not even be exactly, you know, why people turned up on the day, but it's what the narrative has become. And it's how that, well, there was interrogation, but it was done by people who ended up, some of them, dead. So, you know, Cory Aquino was no hero and no saint. And the technocrats in her government were no heroes and no saints either. They did things like, you know, declare to the creditors of the Marcos regime that they would pay back all the debts in full, and they you know, put a clause in the legislation that said that the debt would be paid before health would be paid, before education would be paid. I mean, this was, they weren't drawing a line between Marcos Senior and the new era. There actually was no, on the elite level, there was very little kind of like drawing a line under this and saying we won't do this again. There was a lot of continuity in kind of the way that elite politics works. So I think the responsibility for this lies obviously with the you know, political actors, but but it's this kind of very historically and deeply embedded ambivalence, which is kind of the ingredients or the of both things, I think.
We'll just have to wait and see what Marcos would do for the next People Power anniversary. We'll see what would happen.
It's such an interesting time, and I use the word interesting kind of hesitantly because it's serious and it's, you know, it's life or death stuff. And it's devastating, the result, you know, because a lot of my friends and colleagues did have this personal experience with the Marcos Senior regime. It's you know, to see kind of history and the historical record being wiped, replaced.
So next question, what do you think is the relationship between political agency of the middle class and these ideas of ambivalence? You know, maybe it comes from the, your book mentions a lot of attempts of the middle class trying to act democratically, but the impression I got was there's a lot of stumbling on the way, maybe, it didn't really fully consolidate, you know. So maybe you can comment on the political agency of the middle class, you know, or the efficacy of them as a political actor. So what do you think about that?
I think, you know, one of the things that's interesting in the studies on the middle class in the Philippines to date is this kind of gap in understanding between kind of what are largely kind of conservative attitudes about politics that are found in sort of survey responses, and then these kind of moments of radicalization of the middle class, for example, People Power 1 and 2. So, and we haven't really been able to, you know, very successfully or maybe very convincingly explain the relationship between kind of what are rather conservative, you know, I don't want to get too involved in politics and so on, and then suddenly you have this massive moment. And I think that's evidence of ambivalence, but it's also interesting, I think, that, and I think this is true of people who are ambivalent about democracy more broadly outside the Philippines. And this is sort of research that I'm only just beginning to do, but is that you're likely to put a lot of emphasis on extra constitutional kind of means of changing things as much as you do on elections and democratic kind of institutions. And I mean, I remember when I was doing my internet, I was interviewing somebody who was very involved in election watching. So the election watchdog, you know, kind of making sure that the elections were credible and so on. And this person said to me, oh, but elections are just one means of changing things. You know, it's not the only means. It might be kind of to Western democracies, they think elections are the be all and end all, but we don't. You know, sometimes we believe that we have to take things into our own hands. And I found that a really interesting, rather offhand comment from somebody who was really invested in elections, sort of saying, admitting that basically, you know, it's one kind of string in the bow, but it's not the be all and end all. So I think, you know, that's an interesting reflection that I need to think about more, about how ambivalence plays into that. And I think, you know, the fact that in 1986 you changed the regime via a people power moment that was extra constitutional, and then in 2001 you had this moment where a sitting president who was popularly elected was de-seated by an extra constitutional protest movement largely led by middle class is interesting. So there's something in that about how people see their agency, how they see the efficacy of their agency. And, you know, likely it's an acknowledgement that elections are not the place to where agency can be expressed most strongly.
Yeah.
But clearly with the election of Duterte, that was that was kind of like a kind of a radical. They knew that in electing him, it was something that was shocking and radical and dramatic, and so it kind of had all the ingredients of that, but it was actually an election. It's a bit of a mishmash answer, but that's kind of what I have been thinking about in terms of middle class agency. But the other thing to mention that I think is interesting is that there are these kind of presumptions about the role of the middle class in Philippine studies. One of them is that to the extent that the middle class were involved in politics or have been involved in politics, it's really a case of ideological hegemony. So the middle class have been very much manipulated by the elite and, you know, just kind of coerced into democratic politics. Benedict Anderson, at the end of his seminal essay on Cacique democracy, talks about, you know, the kind of gambling effect. You're in a casino, but you're never going to win, kind of thing. And so the implication is that the middle class have been duped into it somehow. They believe that it's, oh, this is actually transformative, when really the elite know that it's not. And the second kind of assumption is that, you know, any political identity of the middle class only emerged in the early 1980s, in the precursor to people power. Because of this kind of ideological hegemony, there's no point considering the political identity of the middle class prior to that, because basically whatever the elite thought or whatever their, you know, the patron-client kind of dynamics ordained, then that's what the middle class thought. And what I think is really important, and what I was able to kind of uncover, I hope, in the book, is that the role of the middle class politically our analysis of that really needs to begin. There's a lot more to explore there. Yes. And I think by exploring that, we'll really begin to unpack, you know, what's happening in the contemporary kind of period.
Borja, anything?
Yeah, I think one of my last few questions. So, given that democratic ambivalence may be a given, how can we reconceptualize democratization itself as a process? Oops, sorry. I think I'm a bit choppy. Wait.
Maybe I can also, yeah. The other question is democratic ambivalence, this is necessary? Is it something that we have to cure, or is it something that we need to adjust with, or like, what do you think? Is it, how do we move forward then from the knowing that we have this democratic ambivalence?
Perhaps I'll try and answer that question, and then maybe I'll come to the other more profound one. If I get to it. I mean, I kind of basically not only sympathize with, more than that, I kind of defend ambivalence in the book. And I do that, well, on the one hand, I kind of, you know, I find it in the Philippines, and I find its source to be, you know, largely the colonial legacy of the American period. So I really would argue strongly that the kind of responsibility or the blame for that be placed where it belongs. And so that, you know, we stop saying in the literature implicitly or explicitly that Filipino middle class people just don't understand democracy, or they're not doing democracy right, or they're, you know, they've got this kind of authoritarian nostalgia, which I, as a term, I don't really warm to, because I think it's pejorative. I think it's it's demeaning. It's deprecating. I'm a defender of ambivalence, and I also am a defender of ambivalence because I think normatively, and maybe this gets to the second question, we need to accommodate the complexity of responses to democracy within our thinking about how democracy works. And actually, to be ambivalent about something is to kind of withhold certainty. And if you think about the way democracy works and what democracy hinges on, it actually hinges on an absence of certainty. I mean, it's different from monarchy, it's different from dictatorship, because elections and institutions that we have in representative democracy allow us every so often to say, I don't agree with you anymore. I want to kind of throw you out and have someone else. So it's this kind of absence of certainty that is kind of inherent to the democratic idea. The fact that you can actually make things better if you want to. The fact that people, why would their agency matter, but that it can change things in a democracy. You can actually change things. So I think ambivalence has a really important role that we've underestimated in the way democracy works, and we somehow need to accommodate it. I'm not sure about kind of democratization, but I think in terms of kind of a working democracy, I think ambivalence is an inevitable part of living democratically, but also an important, a kind of necessary part of living democratically. But in terms of kind of, you know, thinking kind of more real politic about what it means and is it dangerous and so on, I mean, I think ambivalence can be a weapon against those who would concentrate power, right? It can, it says, I will withdraw my support from you and place it somewhere else because I'm not going to wholeheartedly commit to you. So in that way, it's very powerful, and it can be a weapon that can be used for to sort of deepen democracy. But I would kind of say, you know, use it wisely, because if you take that power and place it on somebody else, you know, place it from a kind of like a dysfunctioning electoral system and a dysfunctioning political system, and you place it on one individual who promises to fix that up, well, then you're just transferring the problem from one place to the other. This is not transformative. So, and I guess the other thing is that we know, you know, it's very clear that ambivalence can be easily mobilized by populist actors. Mm-hmm. And this is a danger. And this is something we have to be careful about. I mean, mm-hmm. that's definitely happened in the Philippines, and it's not only a Philippine story. That's a story yeah. much broader than the Philippines. So for this, we need to be very careful. But to those people who would say, well, then ambivalence is bad because it might, you know, it might produce a Duterte or a Trump or so on, I would say, yeah, but like diminishing ambivalence and telling people they can't be ambivalent is perhaps more dangerous because you're actually telling people to stop thinking for themselves, to stop critically kind of engaging, to stop kind of being watchful and all these things that democracy lives and breathes on. I would say we have to live with ambivalence. We have to learn to live with it. We have to know its dangers, and we have to, you know, heed the warnings of its dangers. Mm-hmm. But, you know, perhaps if we become more welcoming to it, we can somehow corral it and make it work. And I'm hoping that, you know, my hope, I guess, in the Philippine case is that it finds a resting place or a home that's a little bit more stable than a Duterte election or a Marcos election. You know, that we don't have to get rid of it altogether, but that we can find a place for it to live, which is a little bit less tyrannical. So I guess that's how I think about it.
It's interesting. You can consider accommodating uncertainty as another title for something. You know, that's catchy. I think that's a very interesting note to cap the discussion on. But maybe if you have any final messages to
messages also. I mean, I don't have anything profound to say. Only that, you know, it's interesting to study a place that's not, you know, it's not where I'm from, and it's not my, you know, my story. I guess it's a story that's lived by other people, and I consider it a great kind of privilege to have been able to be part of a telling of that story, not the only telling, but one telling of that story. And I consider that just a great privilege, because I've just developed a kind of deep affection and, you know, respect for, you know, the Philippines and, you know, so yeah, I guess that would be my final message.
Mm-hmm. Well, we definitely appreciate your own articulation of our story. In fact, it helped help us realize the great ironies of our democratic society and a lot of its contradictions. So yeah, thank you very much for your contribution and for the elaborations right now. Board, anything to say?
Thanks for having me.
Any final message? Uncertainty is something we live with. I think democracy is founded on uncertainty. I think many philosophers and theorists have already elaborated on that one, so I don't think I could have any more final message. But I would like again to thank Adele here for elaborating on her work. It would be I think this can pave the way for a new, you know, a new age in political science studies. So there may be a paradigm shift soon.
Wow.
And I'm glad to have you here for our podcast.
Right. Okay.
That's very humbling. Thank you.
Yes, and thank you. So let's now move on to our final segment, which is recommendations, where everyone recommends their own, say for instance, maybe a book that they're reading or a movie or series or whatever, a related material that can help enrich and continue thinking about our discussion about democratic ambivalence today. And of course, at this moment, I would like to, again, highlight that we have a partnership with the Ateneo University Press. Of course, the press is one of the publishers of the current book that we're discussing, Chasing Freedom, The Philippines' Long Journey to Democratic Ambivalence by Adele Webb. So please, of course, first and foremost, check that out. Get your own copy so you can read it for yourself. You can get that at a discounted rate at Lazada, and just click the link in the show notes below and you can get it at a discounted rate. It's also available in Shopee and, of course, the Ateneo Press's personal site. And perhaps maybe another book that I would like to recommend, perhaps is related to class analysis, is Elite and Ilustrados in Philippine Culture by Carolyn Howe, who also, in a way, has her own insights about Philippine middle class. And take note that people presume that Ilustrados and the revolution are predominantly, again, elites, but there are also quite a few of them are also of the middle class. And in a way, the Ilustrado label in a way includes much more than the richest of the rich, which people presume to be. In fact, a lot of our propaganda movement, José Rizal himself wasn't quite the richest of the rich per se, although he's maybe upper middle class. So yeah, and there are also manifestations of this not only in Philippine history, but also in culture, in certain forms of literature, you know, certain works. And this is all discussed by Carolyn Howe in this book, also produced by the Ateneo University Press. So a lot of great books about Philippine scholarship and literature there. So yes. Adele, do you have anything to recommend for our listeners?
Well, I'm currently reading The Sovereign Trickster by Vincent Raphael. Okay. Mm-hmm. So I definitely, it's a book about Duterte, and I definitely recommend that. I mean, he's such a wonderful writer, and mm-hmm. I've found his stuff for a long time to be really rich and interesting and interestingly formulated, not kind of conventional in its analysis. So mm-hmm. I definitely recommend that people check that one out, The Sovereign Trickster.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you, Adele. Borj, any recommendations?
Again, I would second your recommendations from our partners in Ateneo Press. I do have two more additional ones. One would be by Renato Constantino, Dissent and Counterconsciousness, which is a very early survey of Filipino values, well, Filipino political values and attitudes, really. So it's time for me to reread Constantino just to ground by further, and I do recommend our listeners to read it as well if they can find a copy. I think you can easily find a copy of Dissent and Counter Dissent. It's available on secondhand bookstores on Facebook. Next one would be a specific chapter in the book Elections for Sale, edited by Frederick Schaefer. So the specific chapter for this one would be, I think, one of the concluding ones regarding the effectiveness of voter education, written by Frederick Schaefer. So he elaborated on the lingering chasm between, you know, middle class oriented voter education and, of course, the mentality, the life experiences of our more impoverished voters. So yeah, there's still a lingering gap, which again we're also dealing with civic education in our own project. So that's a very curious chapter to deal with.
I think you can also find that book in Ateneo Press. So yeah, really, it's the home for great books. Yeah. But
celebrating its 50th anniversary.
Thank you very much. Yes. So those are great recommendations. Thank you, guys. Adele, any would you like to let the listeners know where they can find the rest of your works, maybe if they want to read more from you?
Okay, that's a good question. Well, you can go, I don't know if people use things like Google Scholar. Mm-hmm. I have a profile on Google Scholar, so you can find a list of works there. Or if you go to my ResearchGate page, a lot of most of the works are available for download there, even if they're not open access. There should be copies available there. So that's probably the easiest way to find the work.
We'll include links for that one in the description.
Oh, yeah,
for
our episode. Know them off by hand. If you Google my name, it might come up.
Okay. So, yes, thank you very much, everyone, for a great discussion. So the PI podcast can be found on Spotify, YouTube, and Anchor. Please all follow us on Spotify and Facebook, our Facebook page. And if you have any recommendations or questions or suggestions for our podcast, you may email us at pipodcastph@gmail.com. But until the next episode,
magandang gabi, mga ka-PI.